I think it would be, you know, if you start evaluating the partition function graphically, as you could do if you had indirections, then it would be the same connection that the analog of W would be the thing that would be the sum of connected graphs as opposed to the disconnected graphs. So that logic is just really, it's the logarithm that does that, and that would be right. Equally true for the.
Could you say that a little bit again? I think I was playing catch up when you were making the point the first time. Maybe didn't take it in.
Yeah, it's just that if you take the Z is a sum of all graphs, and so if in particular if we kind of look at the thing with four external lines, you know, that includes graphs like that, you know, like that. That's an interaction, let's say, like you know that. And so this would be a disconnected graph. These two are connected. And so if I take the connected part, it would be I would not include that. I would just only write that plus that, but I would not include that. And then the definition of these things doesn't have to be done. Perturbatively, in terms of graphs, you can kind of recursively define the connected part. It's not complicated, but at the top of my mind, I don't think I have it fresh in my mind as to what the definition would be. But you can define the connected part, which effectively does this for graphs, but define it in a way which is not relying on having a graphical expansion. You can kind of there is an abstract way of defining it. Not that abstract, is it? But there's a way of defining it which doesn't rely on breaking it up into graphs. And so, the reason that people define that is that in terms of graphs, it's getting rid of the disconnected ones. Excuse me. And so the thing is that the derivatives of Z, in this case 4, would be that, whereas the derivative of W would be that. Excuse me. So if I exponentiate excuse me. And that's kind of not an obvious statement, but it's just true that if you look at the combinatorics you'd have to do to subtract off the disconnected graphs, the taking the logarithm does that for you. Because if you think about it, you know, if I have z is equal to 1 plus small thing plus small thing squared, so this is some expansion and perturbation theory. Then when I do, you know, log of z, it's going to be log of that whole thing. That'll be 1 plus z, and then it'll be, you know, some other combination with some other factor at order z2, and so on. And these coefficients are going to be the ones that correspond to keeping the subclass of graphs. So it's just the expansion of the logarithm is exactly the combination you would need to get rid of the disconnected graphs. Is that? Not obvious by any means, but it's true.
So, is there a mathematically rigorous way of proving that W is the function of the
network? Is what the that is? No, you don't have to do that because there's a way of defining connectedness which is not relying on the perturbative expansion. So. And that's the thing, I can't remember exactly what you do, but it's more or less, maybe I can come back next class with that, but it's, you define it in terms of, if you know what the disconnected, you know, endpoint function is, you can define what the disconnected n plus 1 point function is, and then you recursively define it that way. And it's just basically, you're defining it to subtract off what would have been practice if you did graphs, would have been the thing that gets rid of the disconnected one. Same thing for the 1PI ones. You can define those in a way which isn't specifically requiring you to go through and set it up in terms of graphs.
Is it possible to find the E-point graph?
Probably, but you know, it's like saying, can you find any particular virtue in the Bible? You know, the answer is yes, but but where? And is it expressed clearly? It might be, you know, but there's lots of places where this is done. I think Coleman, in one of his Erici lectures, has a nice discussion of these generating functionals and which ones are and why the logarithm gets rid of the disconnected ones. Those are the two that come to mind. But mostly they come to mind because they're old enough that when I was learning this stuff, they were already existed. And I'm sure there's better ones. Someone was saying that the Schwartz book does it.
Okay.
It depends on what you're trying to do. So, you know, if you're doing scattering, usually what happens is that, you know, the disconnected graphs are just, you know, if you, a 4-point scattering process could be, or 6-point scattering process, or 8-point scattering process might be 2 particles scattering on Earth, 2 particles that might scatter on Mars, and they didn't care about each other. And so in practice, you don't do that because you don't care. So in practice, you're normally doing the connected graphs because you're, that's the thing that's, that's where everybody's talked to each other, and that's the difference between if you subtract off, nothing happened. That's the thing that that counts. So in practice, you're doing the connected graphs. And then depending on the question you ask, you might be interested in 1PI graphs or not, and that's more to do with, are you trying to focus on the divergences, or... It's also true that when you integrate out short distance physics to get the Lagrangian, there's a sense in which that's the 1PI action kind of... there's a sense in which the Lagrangians that we write down are actually special cases of these 1PI. I'm lying to you a little bit there, but it's almost true. I didn't do the sound check for the guys at home. Can you guys can you hear us, and can you test that your voice works?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I heard you. Thank you. So, Serge, how's the COVID going?
Oh, it's going better and better, but still at home.
Yeah, well, as long as you don't have a bad version of it, it sounds like that you can do without.
It's not ideal. I mean, it's not ideal. It's a bit, but I mean, I survive it, so it's good.
Yeah, if you're not in the hospital, you're already ahead of the game, right?
Is there a sense?
Many senses. So, you know, all I'm ever using is Gaussian integrals. And that's, so for that, it's not such a big deal. But in principle, they aspire to do more than that. And so there's a multiple issues. One of them is, if you're doing the one that I'm talking about where it's a phase rather than exponential, there's a convergence issue there, right? And it's, you know, There's some of the folklore about this is not true. So if you did a one-dimensional integral, you know, that actually converges. You could stick that on a computer and it converges.
Right.
Whereas, you know, of course, this converges better, right? The e to the minus x squared over 2. The thing is that for a multi-dimensional integral, when you start doing multiple copies of this, and you want to switch between doing the integral over, you know, say x, y, and z. I want to change variables to polar coordinate something, and then do multi, you know, and think of the iterated integral as being a multi-dimensional integral. That requires convergence more than this one has. So if you have more than one integral, then it becomes more questionable to define what you mean by this kind of an integral, whereas that doesn't happen here. And so the depending on how you feel about, you know, the functional integral has got lots of variables in it. So if you're only doing Gaussian integrals, it doesn't really matter. But if you're doing it on a computer or something, then people typically will rotate to imaginary time so they don't have the convergence issues at least. But even then, you've got a whole, it depends on what your action is. You know, if your action, you know, this is something which you know has a nice saddle point at x equals 0, but if your action as a function of fields has a direction which is very, very flat, you know, then it could be that you're accumulating a lot of contributions which are not being suppressed by the integrand, and And so then you have to look at a case by case basis. What's the, how you set those things up? I think if you discretize everything, you can make this into ordinary integrals. In some level, you can put it on a computer, and then those are certainly well defined. But the continuum limit of that is the subtle part. So, but anything we're going to use here is perturbative, which is means that all of those hard issues I don't have to worry about. All right, so. The thing I wanted to start with first was right. So we're doing the Feynman rules, and so you know our Lagrangian is you know it's a free part and an interacting part, and our free part is minus 1/4 you know, f mu nu minus psi bar. P slash plus M psi. And in principle, there would be a gauge fixing condition here too. So if you're doing a, the nice thing about QED is that you're able to finesse these gauge issues. Yeah, the way I was doing it is I was choosing a gauge where it's not a covariant gauge, but I've chosen one. And in principle, you'd want to add a gauge fixing term here too, which I'm gonna not talk about because it's another thing, another complication. And in our three lectures, it's not the highest priority. And then we had the coupling here, which is I times the charge times psi bar, you know, gamma mu psi a mu, basically. This is the L interaction. And so then we're interested in calculating things like, you know, correlation functions, which I'll get more specific about in a second, but let's just leave it general to start off with.
So we want some can the camera zoom in, please?
Oh yeah, the request is to zoom in on the board if you can. Thank you. So we'll have an integral over A, integral over psi, psi bar, e to the I action, and we'll have the free action, and then we're going to be writing out, you know, we'll have our operators, O1, and that's times, you know, 1 plus I times the interaction, Lagrangian action, plus I squared over 2 times the interaction n squared. And we just plug those things in, and off we go. And I've been saying repeatedly that you know, so every interaction is going to turn into, we're trying to figure out when pairs of fields appear that can be paired off and represented by the integral of the Gaussian integral is always taking pairs of fields and replacing them by inverses of the operators that are appearing in the quadratic piece. And so, that's going to be those are the Feynman propagators. And so the interactions are going to appear as places where those correlation functions end, and they're all associated with specific positions because these fields are all evaluated at a specific position. And these operators would also involve those fields, and so we'd be trying to connect together this for any specific choice. Let's take an example. So let's say we calculate, you know, a mu of x, a nu of x, of y. That would be, you know, dA, dpsi, d psi bar, e to the I, s naught, a mu of x, a nu of y, then 1 plus all the interaction stuff. So we'd have specific fields, and all the fields in an operator language, I'm going to write them in terms of creation and annihilation operators. I'm going to jump back and forth between the path integral and the operator language, just because I'd like to. The path integral is easy for writing correlation functions, but for S matrix elements, it's also useful to have the operator version because that makes the identification of what external lines in the S matrix would be given in terms of. So in the operator language, we had a mu of x was sum over the polarizations of an integral d3k divided by the square root of 2 pi cubed twice the energy as a function of k, epsilon mu of k lambda, ak lambda e to the I kx, plus the complex conjugate, basically. And psi had a similar expression, which was sum over the two polarizations of integral d3p, same factor. In that case, we had u of p sigma c of p sigma e to the I p dot x plus v of p sigma a bar star p sigma minus I. And a similar thing for psi bar, where I just take the bar of everything. So in one of these Feynman graph stories, you can read off what the rules are. So if I were to do scattering, then what I would be doing is I'd have a bunch of external lines, which would be the initial and final states I would have on this side and this side if I was doing scattering. And I would not have fields for a scattering matrix. And I have a bunch of interactions. So if my interactions in this case, I only have one, and it always involves two fermions coming in and a gauge boson coming out. So graphically, that's something like this. And one of these is a psi bar, one of them is a psi. So they don't destroy the same particles, right? So a psi destroys an electron and creates an anti-electron. Psi bar destroys an anti-electron and creates an electron. So I can't kind of... in a fermion line, I have to distinguish between is it the particle or the antiparticle that's being destroyed. So that's traditionally done by putting an arrow on to keep track of the flow of fermion number. And so that means that particles, let's say this is the time's running that way. So if these are particles coming in from the past, and maybe there's an antiparticle going out, then what I have to do is connect these lines up in a way where the arrows match. Because what that's saying is that if I look at a pairing, if I have a bunch of psis and psi bars, if I try to pair these guys off an integral, I get zero because the fields we know commuted. The thing that gives me something non-zero is the psi with a psi bar, and so I can't attach these guys to either of these ends. I can only attach it to one end because I have to have a non-zero. I have to have a psi with a psi bar to get a non-zero contribution. Because in the path integral, that's because the psi and a psi bar are being tied to each other up there. There's no psi squared term or psi bar squared term. And in the operator language, that's because in order for the particle that's being created to be then destroyed in the vacuum expectation value, you had to create and destroy the same particle, the electron or the positron. So then now if we were calculating at some order in perturbation theory, there's a factor of q for every vertex. And so if we're working at order q to the fifth or something, we'd have some number of these guys, one for each order of perturbation theory. And then what we're then doing is we're trying to connect these lines in all possible ways and counting the ways we do that to get a particular graph. So first thing I want to do is write down what the lines mean and what the vertices mean. So for each vertex, I'm just taking, in the operator language, what I'm doing is I'm taking these guys and I'm asking, what is coming along. So that's a field, that's a field, that's a field, and these guys are all just coefficients, the I, Q, and the gamma mu. So from that point of view, in this picture where, if I put the Dirac matrix indices here, M, N, and psi N, which I won't do very often, but if I do it now, then if this thing has got an M label and an N label, and this has got a mu label because it's this field, then the coefficient that goes with this will be, if I read off from this, there's going to be, the Lagrangian gives me a factor of I, Q, gamma mu, M, N. But what's appearing in the path integral is not that, it's I times interaction. So I have to multiply that by I because it's e to the I action that was being expanded. So I have a, an I times times whatever was in the Lagrangian. And then the propagators are, so the fermionic propagator MN is just the thing that we've talked about. It's the, it's the integral d4p over 2 pi to the fourth. It's the thing that, that we've calculated before is the Feynman propagator. It's basically 1 over d slash plus m. And so d slash plus m is ip slash plus m in momentum space. So I want to divide by that. And the so the what I'm going to use is that ip slash plus m times minus ip slash plus m is equal to p squared plus m squared. And so we know that the Feynman propagator gives me p squared plus m squared in the denominator. And so what I need to do is multiply by minus I p slash plus m, because if I now act on this with d slash plus m, this will cancel that, and I'll just be left with the integral of the, this is x and this is y. I'll be left with the integral of this, which is a delta function, and that's what it means to be the inverse. So the unit matrix in field space is the delta function. And the 2 pi's make sure that if I hit this with d slash plus m, I get the integral of d4p over 2 pi to the fourth times this, which is a delta function with no 2 pi's, because this cancels the 2 pi's that I would have gotten if I had just had the integral of d4p. And then, but it's, again, I'm inverting the quadratic part of the action, and the action is e to the I times this, so I should have a minus I here. There's a 1 over I for every propagator. There's always an I for every vertex, because it's e to the I action. And the same thing for the gauge boson. That's a mu and a nu. And this is x and this is y. I'm going to call this, what are we going to call this? Let's call this s of x, y, or x minus y. So we'll have, again, a minus I because it's e to the I action. If I want to invert the quadratic part of that, the I goes in the denominator. Integral d4, 4k. 2 pi to the fourth. We have a 1 over k squared minus I epsilon that we always were getting for the Feynman propagator. And again, if I hit this with box, it's going to give me 1 over k squared. But then in the gauge I've been working with, it was a weird gauge. So I have a pi mu nu of k. And remember, pi mu nu of k was a to mu nu. It was the sum over the polarizations of the spins. And so that was a to mu nu, and then there was a piece which was proportional to p mu with some coefficient. I don't care what it is. And then there was another piece. It was symmetric in the end, so there was a corresponding piece with the indices removed. And then there was a piece which was non-covariant. And in the operator story, that non-covariant piece went through and killed off the Coulomb interaction. And so the point of the path integrals, I don't have to worry about that anymore. So this is all I'm going to need for the propagator. And if I had been more honest about the gauge fixing term here, if I had added a piece to break the gauge invariance, like d mu a mu squared or something like that, if I take this, the operator that's appearing here between the a's, it doesn't have an inverse because it's got a zero mode. There's a symmetry in the problem. If I take a mu goes to a mu plus d mu some parameter, then the operator that appears, if I wrote that this term, if I integrate by parts to write it as being a mu, a nu times some operator, the operator would have been, box a to mu nu minus d mu d nu or something like that. And this thing, when it acts on this, gives zero. And so that says that this operator has a zero eigenvalue, so it can't be inverted. And so the gauge fixing, the way the gauge invariance is making you hurt here is the ability to invert this operator to get a matrix down here is being thwarted by the gauge invariance. So that's why we choose a gauge, and I chose a non-covariant gauge in the operator language. But you can choose a covariant one if you like. But the point of that is that in electromagnetism, all of that story is just to do with how you choose these terms here. If I do it in a covariant gauge, it's always going to be true that it's involving p mu and something else. And I'm about to show you that p mu in a propagator never contributes, so it doesn't really matter what alpha is, so I won't write it out again. And so that's what I'll keep track of for the propagator of the photon. For external lines, if we were doing scattering, a final state line, if that's an electron, means we have a final electron So if we take our field operator and ask who creates the electron that goes out in the final state, it won't be this guy because this guy destroys an electron or creates a positron. So I have to, so the psi bar term will be the thing that'll have a creation operator for an electron. So the thing that'll appear here is all the coefficients of this appearing in psi bar. So that'll be these factors, a u bar, and then this exponential with a, I forgot to write the exponential here. So this is e to the I k x minus y. So this would be something like u bar. This will have some momentum if it's a final state particle and some spin. So u bar of p sigma divided by the square root of 2 pi cubed times twice the energy times e to the minus I p dot x. And similarly, if a final antiparticle would have been v bar, an incoming particle would have been u and e to the ipx. And so you can kind of go through just by reading off the coefficients of these guys for the initial and final states.
In the photon propagator, so the momentum is k, so what are p and alpha?
K, sorry, thank you.
Okay, so it's okay. So p should be k, and then what is alpha?
Alpha is anything.
I'm
about to argue that if I take different gauges will give you different alphas, but I'm going to argue that whenever this appears in any amplitude, it's going to cancel. It's going to give you zero in the answer. I haven't shown you that yet, but I'm going to prove it in a second. So it's not going to matter what alpha is because it's not going to appear in any answers. Okay.
Okay.
Is your hand up? Or...
debating it. Yeah. So I've done some Feynman diagram stuff, and then you follow these rules of the integral. This seemed like a lot more, not involved, but there was a lot more logic. Was this just like, do you just have like all this experience, so you know where all these terms need to come from?
All it really is following your nose. If I do what I tell you I'm doing, if I got this Gaussian integral story, then the Gaussian integral is always, I'm taking the inverse of whatever's in the Lagrangian, and I'm taking all possible pairs of the monomials in front of the exponential. And if I just did that for this action, I would be finding these things. And so I kind of know what it's going to be because I've done it before. But it's, because this is the inverse operator for d slash plus m, right? If I hit it with d slash plus m, these choices are all normalized such that this gives me a delta function. And this is not quite the inverse of that operator because that operator doesn't have an inverse, but if you kind of added an arbitrary piece to break the gauge invariance, which is what the alphas are doing, then this is the thing that you would have gotten. And so, and these factors, what I'm trying to drive home is that these factors, the 2 pi's, there's no debate about them because if this thing had to be the inverse operator of d slash plus m, that tells you there's 4 powers of 2 pi here, and then there's no options. And these things for the external lines are coming because if I had had some final state, some final electron, let's say, that's just this. Right? It's A star on the vacuum complex conjugate, right? So I'm just looking for the guy that has this in it. And now I'm confusing myself. I'm giving you a story which is, yeah. So P sigma is A star P sigma. So if I asked, what I gave you here was the rule for an incoming line rather than an outgoing line. Doesn't matter. And then the other one is the opposite. But you can kind of see what you're doing is when you're looking at the operator level, those inverse propagators, the inverse operators are coming because I've got a matrix element of vacuum, bunch of A's, stars, and A's. And so whatever has to happen here to get something non-zero, whatever's being created has to be destroyed somewhere. So you're looking for pairings of these things, and so they have to be the same thing. And so it's the same combinatorics is happening that I'm looking for contractions where I'm comparing. For every A, there had to be an A star, and then they have to have the same momentum and spins, and you can read off what the coefficients are because it's just everything else in the field, right? And so for the final state, if this guy was to do with the final state being a particle, then if I contract that with this guy who's coming from a field, then the coefficient will be whatever's left in the field, and that's kind of where that came from. And the same thing for the initial particles. You can just read off from the field expansions what the expressions are for the external lines. And for the internal lines, you've got two things here, both of which came from a field, and there's a particle. Typically, there's a particle part or an antiparticle part, depending on because the fields all came with the psi was always schematically A plus A bar star. Psi bar will be something like A star plus A bar, and so I can get an A bar star with an A bar, or I can get an A star with an A. So there's two ways in which any particular pair of these A's will go. Any pair of fields will give me two ways in which I get a non-zero combination of these A's and A bars, and that's exactly the Feynman propagator, which we'd calculated before, and that's always giving you this. So these rules in the operator language are giving you the same rules as you get from path integral language.
Yeah.
But the important thing is that the factors are not mystery. It's just really, once you've normalized your fields, and these factors came because we wanted the algebra for these guys, where C with C dagger is one, to make these guys commute in the canonical way. And so it's there's no freedom here, right? So it's all dictated. And so now it's just a matter of just putting together the ingredients for any particular graph. And the only thing that's at all complicated is the numerical factors here. So you contract all possible ways in which connecting these lines is like choosing which of these guys are pairing off with each other to give you something non-zero. And so then the numbers of ways you can do that is the combinatorics you're doing in doing the path integral or doing the operator version of it. And there was something I wanted to say before I do the next thing. Maybe I should do, So then what do you do with a graph? I didn't quite finish this. So let's say we were doing for a graph, what's going to happen is you're going to have a whole bunch of factors of these, and they depend on this is a matrix. So it depends on, this is a matrix here, MN. So it's a Dirac matrix. It depends on X and Y. And so, any particular graph at some point we're going to evaluate this graph. Let's look at this one. So every vertex has a position label. And I'm imagining that the thing we're calculating for this graph will be, a mu of x, a nu of y. So the thing we specify is x and y and mu nu. So let's say this is x and mu, and this is y and nu. And so this vertex here will be x1. So the things that label the vertices are, there's a spinner label and there's a mu nu label. So let's call this one, let's say this is alpha mn. And this is these are Dirac indices, and that's the gauge, the Lorentz index. And then say beta, pq, if you like. And then what has to happen to get this graph is we had to, the guy who's being destroyed has to be the one who's being created here. So what's the rule for this would be, I have two propagators, two gauge propagators. So if I call that, I didn't give it a name yet. So let's call this delta mu nu of x minus y. So this will be, delta mu alpha of x. This is at position, say, let's call them z1 and z2. X, z1, or x minus z1. Then we'll have a delta nu beta of y minus z2. And then we'll have two fermion propagators. So we'll have an S. Now you remember the way that the Dirac indices, if you kind of track which index, if I work along this line, there's a difference between getting the transpose or the matrix of the transpose matrix. If you follow through where the Dirac indices were here, if this is tracking the way fermion number flows, it's when you go backwards along this line is the indices will be coming in the normal matrix multiplication form. So if I take this to be M and this is N, and this is P and Q are bad. Let's say it's R and S. So this will be a propagator SM. And it depends on Z2 minus Z1. And then this will be a propagator S. They're both R's. No, this is MN, that's an N. It'll be n r of z1, z2 minus z1. And then the vertices were these factors. So I have basically minus q times the gamma matrix, where the gamma matrix is again done reading that way. So I'll have a minus q, and I'll have two of them because there's two vertices. Then we'll have a gamma alpha mn and a gamma beta rs. And there's some numerical factor because the numerical factor will be, so this is a second order interaction. So with we had an incoming line here, an incoming line here, and two vertices. So to get this graph, this guy had a choice of one of two things to connect to. There's a factor of two from that. Once I've done that, this guy had to go here, and this guy had to go here, and this guy had to go here, because otherwise the arrows don't match. So there's only two ways to do it, so there's a factor of two. And then it was second order perturbation theory. So in this e to the is, I've got a factor of 1/2 from that. And I have to also, every position in here is getting integrated over, because it's inside the action, and the action is the integral over x of this Lagrangian. So I have an integral d4z1, integral d4z2. And so that's would be the contribution at that order from that graph. And of course, no one does it in position space. On flat space, you know, in curved space, this would be the way to do it, because if you don't have translation invariance in your background, then there's nothing special about momentum space. Oh, thank you. Minus sign for fermion loop. That was one of the things I didn't tell you about. So that minus sign is because it's a fermion loop. And that's because here I didn't give you the whole list of the rules. And this is the one, basically the main one I left off. And that's because in this path integral story, I've been vague about what you do with the fermions. And for the fermions, you have to define what the path integral is. In that case, the classical thing you're integrating, in the same way that you're integrating a classical bosonic field here, you want to integrate a classical Grassmann field here, which anti-commutes with itself without the delta function that you get in quantum mechanics. So the classical guy just anti-commutes. You're integrating anti-commuting variables. And there's some signs associated with that, one of which is whenever you have a loop, you have a sign. Whenever you change the external lines, you pick up a sign for the same reason. So there's some signs you have to be careful about. But again, it's just following your nose. The signs, the way I've told you so far, are easier to do in the operator language because you know exactly what the commutation relations are. And basically, I'm saying that, you know, if you do a circle, you contracted this guy with this guy, this guy with this guy, and then this guy with somebody over here. And so then to bring them together, you had to pass them past each other. And there's an odd number of minus signs you do whenever you anti-commute the fermions by each other. So they both give you the same sign, but it's important that it's there because when you interfere things, the signs will matter. Now this is in position space, but the thing is, you can do these integrals over the z's because all of the dependence of x in here, it's always in these exponentials. So you can just do those integrals, and it's always going to be true that the integral over x will pick up every propagator is going to contribute a momentum, and the vertices will give you so what'll happen is that at any one vertex. So the z's are the only ones we're integrating are the vertices here. So if I look at the integral, say, d4z1, just to track what happens there, it sees these two propagators and that one. So it's going to see the Fourier momentum I use for this is k. Let's say I call this one p, and I call this one q. Those will be the momenta flowing along these representations. The Fourier variable I'm going to use for those guys is k, p, and q. And what'll happen is that here I'm going to get from the vertex, from this propagator, I'll get a contribution, you know, integral d4p. So I'm going to d4z. I'm going to get an e to the I kz. I have to decide which way the momenta are flowing. And so let's just choose the convention for the p such that the momentum is flowing in this particular vertex, they're all flowing in. Just that tells me how to choose these signs here. And so what'll happen in that case is that I'll get this from that propagator. This propagator will give me a plus I P of Z1 coming from that factor. And then there'll be an I Q of Z1 coming from that same factor for the other propagator. And the convention where they're all flowing in is why they're all the same sign. So this integral you can do, and it's just 2 pi to the fourth times the delta function, which expresses four momentum conservation at that vertex, P plus Q plus K. And that happens at every vertex, essentially. So in momentum space, the Feynman rules are similar. All that happens is that the rule now is that instead of integrating over the positions, it's convenient if we Fourier transform these guys too, then everybody's in momentum space. So we can look at the integral d4p over 2 pi to the fourth, d4q, 2 pi to the fourth of e to the I px plus I qy or something like that, or minus I qy, it might be convenient. If we did that, then we'd have everything in momentum space, and then we'd be saying that when we do the integral over x here, the only thing that depends on x is this guy, is this propagator. So all that'll do is that'll say that this external p that we're associating with this external field will become the momentum of this propagator here when we do the integral over x. And the same thing will happen here, so that the k here, I can just label the external lines in by their momenta. I don't need to label them by their positions anymore. Although I keep them mu's and nu's. And so those are the Feynman rules that you normally talk about. And so the only difference is that once we've done that, we don't have these factors anymore in momentum space. And so that's what I'll call this the integral d4p over 2 pi to the fourth. Let me call that S of p. And same thing for here. I'll have a delta mu nu of k where I'll just separate out the integral. And I won't count the minus I. I'll keep that separate. But then everything else, I'll call the delta mu nu of k. And so then the same rule for the graphs you can write down in momentum space. And that would be, so again, the minus sign is there. The combinatorics is the same as before, 2 over 2. We'll have a delta mu alpha of k. We'll have delta nu beta now let me label everybody here. So K, this will be now K, P, Q, and let's call this L as the four momentum. And so I should now be more, I choose a direction. So this guy is going that way, let's say, and I've chosen this guy to be going that way. So that means it's leaving here. And then let's choose this guy to be going, that guy was going that way. Let's choose this guy to be going that way. So L is going that way. So now I've chosen everybody.
Why is the integral, so I would expect that in momentum space, the integral would go away because if you just have a propagator, as long as it's not in a loop, you're not integrating over momenta.
Well, I'm about to derive that. So to start off with, the rule in momentum space will be for what we write down all the propagators, and then for every line, every internal line, we're supposed to integrate, because that's what the Feynman rule was. You know, we did the integral over x, but we didn't do this integral, and it was there, so it's still there. And then the thing you're thinking about is that we can go through and ask, there's a whole bunch of delta functions that are going to be there too, because we know at every vertex we got, where did I write that down? Somewhere I wrote down, I thought that every vertex gives me a delta function of momentum conservation.
Yeah.
Where is that though?
I think you. Yeah, you erased it, but I know what you're talking about. So
the story you're talking about is that when we ask those delta functions to do some of the momentum integral, so how many are left? And then the answer will be one for every loop.
Yeah.
But we haven't got there yet. Okay, so we got this. This is L. And then we have S. Let me write this as a matrix multiplication now. So the matrix multiplication would be, I have to, this is a row, that's a column. This has to multiply this, and then this multiplies that, and then that multiplies that, and then that multiplies that again, so there's a trace. So and this is a trace over S of P In fact, let me always choose my momentum to be going opposite to my Fermion flow. So let me just choose Q to go that way so I don't have to change my conventions for what SP is. So SP then multiplies gamma alpha. That multiplies by S of Q. And that multiplies gamma beta. And then I close the trace. And then we have the minus Q squared. Oh, Q, too bad. Q might not have been the best choice. So let's call that. H. But then, so that's the, I still have the integrals over momenta, so I haven't written down the, so I've got a minus I integral, you know, d4p over 2 pi to the fourth, a minus I integral d4k over 2 pi to the fourth, a minus I integral d4l over 2 pi to the fourth, and a minus I integral d4h over 2 pi to the fourth. That's these integrals and those minus i's. And then what we haven't done yet is the thing I erased. So the vertex in momentum space, when I did the integral over position, that gave me a factor of 2 pi to the fourth times the delta function for the sum of the momenta in that vertex. Times this stuff. So we have an I, which is always there because it's the I action, and then we have the stuff that was explicitly in the Lagrangian. I gamma mu. So this factor we already put in, this factor as well, because that's why I wrote minus q over there. But this factor is not there yet. And we had two vertices, so we have 2 pi to the fourth delta. So that vertex we had p in, h out, and k in. So it's h minus k minus p. And then 2 pi to the fourth delta of, and the other one was h in, p out, and l out. So it's h minus p minus l. So that's the momentum space answer. And so you see that I have got lots of integrals here. Why?
There are four integrals, but there are two delta functions. So,
yeah. So I was expecting to have one integral left, and I guess what's happening is
two d4ls.
Oh yes. So it's, I guess it's so those two of them are left over here. It's still true. Yes, right. That's what's happening. So these integrals are there because I put them in. But if I only wanted to evaluate the thing that was the Fourier transform, I would not write these things explicitly. And so that would be the L and the K integrals. So I want to say that these guys, I don't need to do if I don't calculate. Actually, that can't be right though, right? Because I'm doing the integral. I did this integral. I did these integrals to get that the momentum here was the same as the momentum I put in. I fit in. So that's actually, I'm lying to you. So what happened? Oh, I know what it is. This was really in secret a function of x minus y. I didn't need to do two integrals here. I only needed to Fourier transform the variable that it depended on. So one of these integrals is going to be a stupid integral. So let's write this as integral IP of x minus y and not do the Q integral. So one of these integrals won't be there. Let's get rid of that one. And so now what's happening is that there's three integrals. Again, there's a lot of integrals. Yeah, that's all right. One of these integrals, so if I do the integral over h and l, let's say, so that says that h is equal to k minus p, but it's also equal to p minus l. And so when I use, so let's say I do the h integral with that delta function, and I'm going to use this everywhere, including here, so this becomes a delta function of k minus p minus p. There's a sign where I want to skew here. Oh, that's because I wrote these I changed the sign of one of my momenta here, right? So these delta functions should have been p in, h out, h is k minus p, and h is l plus p, because the momentum in had to be equal to the ones out, h minus p minus l. So one of these, so the one over there, it should have been that h was k plus, no, actually k plus p equals h.
I think from the delta function it is k plus p rather than k minus p from the first delta function.
That's my mistake, right. That's a plus. So if I use that here, then I'm going to get the delta function of k plus p minus p minus l. So it's just the delta function that says that that these external lines have the same momentum. So the upshot was that one of the delta functions does an integral, and the other one says that the external momenta are equal and opposite, which I can use to do the remaining integral over these external photon lines. So the only real integral that's got any interest in it is the one that's over h, if you like. It's the one that's in the loop. So let's pin that down more. So what I'd like to do is do the counting of if I take some random graph with e external lines and l and I internal lines and v vertices, how does it depend on q? How do the two pi's appear? And how does it depend dimensionally on the scales in the problem? And in particular, in the integrals that we're going to do, many of these integrals are going to be diverging. And I'd like to know what's the most divergent any one of these, these integrals that we have. There are going to be integrals left. And this is an example of one where there's an integral left that's not being done by a delta function. I'd like to have an estimate as to, for some random graph, how does it depend on those variables? And the point of that will be to the counting of the q's, the charges, and the two pi's will be to show you that the number of loops is what's count. Each loop costs you a factor of q squared divided by 16 pi squared. That's the expansion parameter that's making the expansion a good approximation. And the other thing will be, you'll see which graphs are diverging, and there's only going to be very specific kinds of external lines that will diverge. And you'll see that they are related to the ones that can diverge will be the ones that we also have terms in the Lagrangian for, that'll have the same number of fields in the Lagrangian as the external lines do. And that's the starting point of the renormalization story. So let me leave that here. So let's take we got some complicated graph. It's got, we can do this any way we want, but let's say we have E gamma photon lines, and we have E electron fermion lines, external lines. And so then we have, so in this graph, let's just draw a particular one just to be concrete. So these are all vertices, let's say. Fermion has to end somewhere, so those guys will all come out. So here's an example where we have, E gamma equals 3, that one, that one, and that one, and E fermion is equal to 1, whoops, the fermion can't stop. There's no interactions that stop a fermion. So let's just get rid of that guy. We'd have 1, 2, 3, 4 electron lines. And then here we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, sorry, start again. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 12, is it? So it's 1, 2, 3, 4. We have 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 11. I want to say there's 11 fermion internal lines. We have IE internal electron lines. We'll have I gamma internal photon lines. So this has no internal photon lines, but let me put one in just to make it interesting. So this would be a case where we have IE equals 11, I gamma equals 1. And how many vertices we have? We've got one. So if as soon as I do that, I've got to change the number of electron lines. So let's not do that. This is I gamma equals 0. Let's leave that guy off. There's no vertex there. So there's 1, 2, 3, and that's not there either. Oh, that was there. Yeah. No, but this there's no vertex in the problem. Ah. The only vertex we have is this one, right? Where that's a photon and that's an electron. And I'm drawing things that are not that. So let's just do something sensible. So let's just take a graph I know exists. So let's take that graph. So this is one where we've got four external photon lines, no external electron lines, four external electron lines, internal electron lines, and no internal photon lines. And the number of vertices, we have four of them. So V vertices. Of V would be 4 in this case. So from the Feynman rules, we know a lot of things, right? So we know that as far as the charges go, every vertex gives us a charge. So we have a Q is the number of vertices. So whatever, so the answer, let's call this A, is going to be, so this is the Feynman rule for this particular graph. It's going to have V powers of the charge. And that's it, right? Because the only place the charge appears is with the vertex. Now the 2 pi's, we get a 1 over 2 pi to the fourth for every internal line, essentially. And we get a 2 pi to the fourth for every vertex. So we'll have a 2 pi to the fourth to the number of vertices minus the number of internal photon lines minus the number of internal electron lines. And then we have an integral d4p, we have that for every internal line, essentially. So every internal electron line, and every internal photon line. And then every propagator, the fermion propagators, if I'm interested in how this behaves for large p, the fermion propagator goes like 1 over p, whereas the photon propagator goes like 1 over k squared. Once I show you that the k mu doesn't matter, and that only the a to mu nu here matters, so then we'll get a 1 over p squared for every internal photon line, and a 1 over p for every internal fermion line. And I just really care about the dimensional analysis here, because I want to know how many integrals are going to be left, and I'm going to just dimensionally say that those integrals are going to go on dimensional grounds, like the biggest scale in the problem in the integral. And I've missed, and I also have a delta function for every vertex, right? Every vertex. Now, in this example, you saw that one of the delta functions survives to be the external, the thing that says that the total number of momenta flowing into the vertex have to be balanced. So momentum conservation has to hold for this whole vertex. So one of these delta functions will turn into a delta function that says that all these external momenta are fixed, or have to sum to zero. And so it won't be available to do the integrals over p. But all the rest of them, I can use the delta function to do one of the p integrals. So the number of integrals will be IE plus I gamma. That's just minus the number of vertices minus one, because one of them becomes the overall conservation of momentum for the whole graph. So that's the total number of, let me just call I the sum of the photon and electron. So it's I minus V plus one. Now, there's a topological identity. So for any surface, any way you partition the surface of a plane, of a two-dimensional surface, it's always true that the sum of the, if I call these guys the faces, these guys the vertices, and these guys the edges, it's always true that the number of vertices minus the number of lines plus the number of faces, I'm going to call that L, that's always equal to 1. If I've done that right, let's just check it here. So here we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 vertices. And we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 lines. 12. And we have number of faces was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right? So that's 8 minus 12 plus 5 is 8 minus 7 is 1. No. Yes. God is great. All right, so by induction, it's true for everything. And the what's going on here is that there's the Euler invariant for any kind of a piling of a disk essentially is what we have here, is the Euler invariant of a disk is 1, and the Euler invariant of the surface is this the number of vertices minus number of edges plus the number of faces. So that's now there, Feynman graphs can't all be written on a disk, right? I might have had a Feynman graph where say this line here. Supposing I had a line here which starts here and it ends here, and I draw it like this, but the line comes out of the board and connects, so although it's crossing these lines, it's not actually, there's no vertex on those lines. That would be something which is not on the disk. But what we'll do is we'll define the number of loops in a graph to be this. And so that means that if you can draw it on a plane, it'll be what you intuitively think the number of loops is. But if it's not on the plane, this is the definition of what the number of loops is. So the number of loops is 1, plus the number of internal lines minus number of vertices, which is that. So you see that for any integral, you're going to get, after you've done the delta functions, use the delta functions to do the integrals, you're going to get an integral for every loop. That's one observation. It's also true that these L and V and I are not all independent of one another, right? So there's two identities that are important. One of them is this one, so the definition of number of loops. And the other one is conservation of line ends. So conservation of ends. And that says that there's more than one way to count the number of ends of a line. You can count the vertices or you can count the lines. And so So if I allow myself to have external lines, so that external lines only have one end, but internal lines have two, then the number of ends would be 1 for each external line and 2 for each internal line. But that's also equal to because all our vertices in QED, all our vertices only have 3 things connected to them, every vertex. So that has to be 3 times the number of vertices in QED. But we actually have more information than that if we separately keep track of the photon and electron lines, because we know that the number of electron lines plus twice the number of internal electron things should be equal to twice the number of vertices, because only 2 of the lines on a vertex are electrons. And the number of photon lines ends plus twice the number of internal photon things has got to be equal to the number of vertices, because there's only 1 vertex on each photon, only 1 photon vertex for each vertex, 1 photon line ending at each vertex. So we can use that to If I add those together, that says that the total number of lines plus twice the total number of internal lines is equal to 3 times the number of vertices, which is conservation of n's for all the lines. And we can use that to simplify some of these things. We can get rid of the number of vertices, for example. So for example, here, we've settled this already. So we know in the other day that this is in secret equal to the number of loops. And we only have one delta function left, which is the overall conservation of momentum. So what we can do now is we can ask, let's keep track of these factors here. So we have, I can express as, what's the useful way to express it? So q to the v is q to the e plus 2i 3. Actually, no, better than that. I got a better idea. What I'll do is I'll get rid of, I'll trade v and I using this identity and this identity. Let's do that. So we know that on the one hand, what's the easiest one to do? V, this says that v is equal to 1 plus I minus L. That means that we have e plus 2i is equal to 3, 1 plus I minus L. So we've got 3i minus 2i is I, is equal to e minus 3 plus 3l. Did I do that right? E minus I. Yeah, I think that's right. And then that means that v is equal to 1 minus L plus this. So it's E minus 3 plus 1 is minus 2, plus 3L minus L is plus 2L. That means that Q appears to the number of vertices, which is E minus 2 plus 2L. And the 2 pi's, I get 2 pi to the 4th to the of v minus I. V minus I is that minus that. So there's going to be that minus that will be 1. That minus that will be minus L. So let's write this as 1 over 2 pi to the 4th to the L minus 1. So let's put that in here now. So we've got Q to the E minus 2 plus 2L. We have 1 over 2 pi to the 4th to the L minus 1. And we have L integrals. And now this, altogether, we have 1 over momentum in these integrals to the I gamma, 2 I gamma plus I E. So if I divide this by 2, so IE plus 2i gamma, just add them together, I'm going to have, that's 1 half EE plus E gamma, sorry, minus this, plus 2v. And v is equal to this. That's minus 1 half the number of e's plus, or sorry, minus e gamma and plus 2e minus 4 plus 4l. Did I do that right? So this, if I think of this as being e gamma plus ee, I've got 2 ee minus ee, that's 3 EE over 2, and I've got an E gamma, 2 E gamma minus E gamma, so it's plus E gamma minus 4 minus 4L. I think that's right. Are you guys working along with me here? Do you, have I made an algebra mistake here? I don't think so. In my notes, I didn't split things up this way, so it's going to be, I can't check with my notes. Let's press on and assume that that's true. So the claim is that this is equal to this, right? So it's 3 halves the number of electron lines plus the number of photon lines minus 4 minus 4L. All right. This, I'm kind of making heavy weather this. So what do we know so far? We know that this amplitude, it's got some things that are specific to the number of external lines, so that'll change from amplitude to amplitude, but we know that it's got a, so it's got a q to the e minus 2, so it has external, it's got e external lines, and then there's a, for, but for every loop, I know that I've got a factor of q to the 2l. I've got an integral d4p divided by 2 pi to the fourth for each loop. And I got one left over, so there's going to be 2 pi to the fourth up front. Let me write this over here. There's a 2 pi to the fourth, and then there's a delta function that was left over for conservation of overall momentum. And then the integrand.
I think 4 minus 4 rather than negative 4, it's positive 4 ahead. Or 1 over p. Yeah, just the exponent of 1 over p.
I wrote it wrong here, you're saying. Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
That was going to burn me. Yeah, good, thank you. So then I have a 1 over p factor. It goes like, there's a 2 I gamma, sorry, 3 half e gamma plus e, or e electron plus e gamma minus 4 minus 4l plus 4l. So this you know, the integrand here depends on the external momenta, it depends on the mass of the electron. There's lots of things appearing here besides p. But when p gets really large and we want to know how does this thing behave at the top end, the biggest thing in the problem will be p. So let's just count the dimensions for the p's and see how bad can it get. And you see that the this is going to diverge. First, before I do that, let's continue with the pi's. I want to keep track of the pi's before I do the divergence story. So we got a 1 over 2 pi to the fourth for every l. That's a 1 over 2 pi squared for every l. But we have to do the integral over p, and the integral over p is going to include some angular integrals, right? So the angular integral in you know, so the volume. You know, the volume of a sphere in n dimensions is 2 pi to the n over 2 divided by gamma of n over 2. That's the area of a sphere embedded in n dimensions times r to the n. So the unit sphere would just be that. And so when you do the integral over the angles, so if we can check it, right? If we take n equals 2 would be, this is a circle, then this will be gamma of 1 half, which is root pi, 2 times root pi, and is 2 pi, oops, no, gamma 1. If n is 2, this is gamma 1, that's 1, and this would be 2 pi, and that just says that the circumference of a circle is 2 pi, you believe that? If we do n equals 3, this is 2 pi to the 3 halves, gamma 3 halves, and so we have 2 pi to the 3 halves over gamma 3 halves. Gamma 3 halves is 1 half gamma of 1 half, which is root pi over 2. So this will be 4 pi, which is the volume, you know, the surface area of a sphere in 3 dimensions. And in 4 dimensions, it becomes 2 pi squared, I think it does. So 4 is 2 pi squared, and this is 4 over 2 is 2. Gamma of 2 is basically 1 factorial, so that's the... So the angular integrals here, in general, will be complicated because there's q's and things, but just to track the pi's, I'm going to count every angular integral here as being 2 pi squared. And so that means that the loop dependent factor is going to be, for every loop, I've got a factor of q squared divided by 2 pi to the fourth times 2 pi squared.
Should the r be to the power of n?
Minus one, yeah. Thank you. And so you can see that this is, every loop is costing me a factor of q squared divided by 2, 4, 16, 8 pi squared. Oh, and if I'd done this carefully, if I do the integral of p dp, if I write that as 1 half dp squared, and this is just because I want to make the answer look like the standard way of writing it, factors of 2 in this order of magnitude thing don't really matter, I would have had an extra factor of half, and that would have given me that would have given me 16 pi squared here. So this is saying that every loop is costing you this factor. So this is the thing that's making the loop expansion a good expansion. So when we decide which graphs to draw, the loops is the thing to focus on rather than the number of vertices, because this is showing you that it's true that the number of vertices matter in the sense that if I choose things with more external lines, I pay more prices of q. But for a fixed number of external lines, I think all the graphs with those many external lines, I get punished for every extra loop. So the first thing to do for any fixed number of external lines is to find all the tree graphs that can be done with that number of external lines, and then we work our way down the loop expansion. So this being small is this is what controls the loop expansion. First, that the expansion is a loop expansion, so it really is a semi-classical expansion, but the loop expansion is semi-classical. Now, the last thing is the divergences. So this is going to diverge if let's have another board. I think I can leave that there. So diverges if this thing is positive, right? If it's positive or zero, if the power of p here on dimensional grounds is zero, it'll be like a logarithm of lambda. And if it's a positive power, it'll be positive. So the condition that this thing diverges will be that the dimension of this thing will be non-negative. So we want let's call it d. D is going to be 4 times L, because there's a d4p for every L. And then there's minus this. So it'll be minus 4L plus 4 plus 4 minus 3 halves E electron minus E gamma. This is called the superficial degree of divergence. And superficial because you can kind of see I'm just basically making a dimensional argument. And so in the story of proving renormalizability, a lot of work was in taking these multidimensional integrals and justifying why this dimensional argument is actually working when you're describing the convergence of these various multiple dimensional integrals. And you get logarithms of things wrong the way I'm doing it. But the moral of the story is basically that that this way of counting is actually giving you the right counting of powers of divergent things. So you see, the good news is, yeah?
Is it 4 minus 4 L? Okay, these are the same thing.
So that's the good news, is that a particular graph, it's not like it gets worse and worse and worse the farther down you go the loop expansion. The divergences are all going to be a fixed size, and higher powers of higher orders in the expansion don't punish you. And that's not true for gravity, for example. What's happening here is that the dimensions of the coupling were dimensionless. And so they didn't cost you, you could have as many of them as you like, and it didn't change the dimensional analysis of the integrals. Where for gravity, where Newton's constant is the dimensions of inverse mass, the more you have of that, the more p's you have to have in your answer, so the more divergent things get. So the more loops you go, the worse it gets, and that's kind of why gravity's, one of the reasons why gravity's harder to do. But you can also see that, sorry?
So that's why gravity is not renormalizable then.
That's part of the story, yeah. Basically, if you have a coupling which has dimensions of inverse powers of mass, you're not renormalizable in the traditional sense of there's a finite number of couplings that you need. And so you can kind of see now whether things are going to diverge in the superficial way is fixed by the number of external lines. And it's not going to be, as soon as this is, so this has to be greater than or equal to zero is the condition that it diverges if I want to finish the sentence. So you see that that means that that 3 halves e gamma, e plus e gamma has to be less than less than 4. And if you think about it, so I didn't emphasize this, but in our Lagrangian, you know, in fundamental units, the action has the units of h bar, right? It's the integral d4x of Lagrangian. So this is dimensionless in fundamental units where h bar is 1. And this is dimensions of length to the fourth. So L has to have dimensions of 1 over length or mass to the fourth. So dimensions of L are mass to the fourth. So that means that this has dimensions of mass squared. And since it's the derivative of A and the derivative is dimensions of mass, then A mu has dimensions of mass, dimension 1. And this also has a, this is a mass, this is a mass. And so that means the dimension of psi is 3 halves, mass to the 3 halves power. And so if I look at this, this is dimensions of mass cubed because it's 2 3 halves, plus 1 is the mass to the fourth, and that's why this was dimensionless in fundamental units. But you can kind of see that this is saying, this condition is saying that the dimension of any operator right down with psis and derivatives, the counting, this is just counting the fields, it has to be less than 4. And so that means that you know, so psi bar psi is already dimensions of mass cubed. That says, so if E were 2, then 3 halves times 2 is 3. This criterion is satisfied by these things in the Lagrangian. If I thought of these things as special cases, if I take the vertex that corresponds to this, you know, that vertex as a special case of one of these graphs, it has 3 external lines where E, you know, EE is 2 and E gamma is equal to 1. That's one of the ones that can diverge because it's that, in that case, this would be 1, this is 2, and this adds up to 4. And that being less than or equal to 4 is the condition that it diverges. But if that diverges, those kind of graphs diverge, then if I add this graph to them, I can give a divergent coefficient to this and cancel the divergence. But if I had something like, supposing there was a psi bar mu nu, a psi bar gamma mu nu, f mu nu, let's say, with some coefficient. That has 2 fermion lines and a photon line and a derivative, right? So this has, why didn't this care about the derivatives? Did we lose something here? I guess I could have, I didn't, what I didn't keep track of was in this dimensional story, I used all the dimensions as internal momenta, right? I didn't use any, I didn't require there to be any external momenta using up some of the dimensions. So if I had asked for, an amplitude to look like this, it would have to have at least one momentum in it because F has a momentum in it. So at least one of those momenta I should have pulled out as an external momentum rather than an internal momentum. And so if I asked, can I get an amplitude diverging which looks like this? So it has one power of the external momenta and it has a photon and it has 2 fermions. My criterion here would be this would have to be one smaller, right? Because my counting of D here should be this minus 1 because I had to one of the powers of momentum is now an external momentum, so I couldn't count it as one of the things in the integral, which is making it diverge. So it diverges by 1 less. So this would have been 3 here. So it would have had this is less than 3. And then this no longer satisfies that criterion, and so it's got to be finite. And so the fact that this is not depending on the number of loops and the fact that it's depending on this specific, it's very restrictive how many external lines you can have then in order to get a divergence is the thing that's saying that the things that are diverging are the same things you already have in your Lagrangian in the end of the day. And I'll make that more explicit later on because we'll calculate corrections to the Lagrangian and you'll see that the ones that are here are going to diverge and things like this won't diverge. That's probably a natural place to stop. What I will do next is, and I'm telling you this partly because you can veto it if this is stuff that you've seen. So I was going to next do the proof that the momentum part of the propagator is always canceling in any Feynman graph. And then dimensional regularization for these graphs. We'll write down the vacuum polarization as an example and take you through the dimensional regularization story, and then the infrared divergence story, which is to show that graphs are going to, in general, diverge in the ultraviolet, but they're also going to diverge in the infrared. So that's the, we've been talking here about divergences when, you know, this n goes to infinity, but there's going to be also divergences when that n goes to zero. And they tell you different things. So, and it, more or less, the ones at the high end are to do with short distance physics that you didn't know anyway. And basically, the choices of the couplings you have in your Lagrangian, those couplings are the things you got when you integrated out short distance physics. You didn't know what they were, and that integration gave it to you. So the dependence on where you decide to divide what you know from what you don't know is always absorbable in the various parameters in your Lagrangian at the ultraviolet end. At the infrared end, what that, if you get a divergence in the infrared, it just means you made a mistake. So that, the thing you're calculating is not a physical thing. So that's the quantum field theory, basically. You know, it's, quantum field theory is one of those things where it's a cruel but fair master. And so as soon as you do something wrong, it punches you in the face. But it only does it when you do something wrong. So if you never do something wrong, you never get punched in the face. And the infrared divergences are you being punched in the face. So when you hit those, the thing is, the thing you're calculating doesn't make sense, is what the theory is telling you. And so then the question is, that's useful to know, because now you have to think about, so what should I be calculating instead of what I'm calculating? Why didn't it make sense? And QED has got a famous example of that. It's kind of the classic example of how infrared divergences, there's a physical, often a physical thing going on that you are not, you didn't bargain for at face value. And it's useful to know that there's a problem. And so that'll be next time. All right. So see you next time.